Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 104.EZ2047, certificate number 31303, the Battle of Palmdale.
You're a fan of war movies, I'm assuming.
I don't have a weekly podcast where I watch flying leathernecks with a bunch of middle-aged guys. So in this room, I'm the least into war movies.
Right.
But I do enjoy a good war movie.
I should say that my war movie podcast, Friendly Fire, does not feature a bunch of middle-aged guys. I am the middle-aged guy. And then there's a younger...
They are youthful compared to us.
Yeah, there's like a Generation Y guy, and then there's a Millennium is the youngest guy, a 30-year-old. We need somebody in there to comment on every war movie that it's problematic.
You don't have a baby boomer.
No, there's no baby boomer. And in fact, one of the guy's wives, one of the other guys...
His wife is a baby boomer.
No, she said at one point, aren't you the baby boomer? Further infuriating me because of Generation X erasure. Because
you're 5 years... You're, what, 5 years away from being a boomer? And to you, that's a huge gulf.
No, I'm 10 years away from being a boomer. There's no...
When does a baby boom end? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, the last possible case you could make, I think, is 1960. If you were born in 1961, how can you possibly be a baby boomer?
Okay.
You know what I mean? I mean, John Flansburgh from They Might Be Giants was born in 1960, and he's not a baby boomer. For the love of... I mean, Obama.
I like how that's your benchmark.
Obama's not a baby boomer. He was born in 60 or 61. He's not a boomer. Come on. We have a lot of baby boomer listeners, and I don't mean to disparage them any more than I normally do.
The U.S. Census Bureau has the baby boomer going to 64.
That's wrong.
You're only 5 years off.
That's so wrong. I mean,
who are you to challenge the U.S. Census Bureau on the basis of John Flansburgh's birthday?
Me. Well, a baby boomer, I think the year 1968 is crucial to baby boomer culture. 1968 is when the boomer generation had its... That was the big celebration, the coming out party.
Assassinations are the big coming out party for the boomers?
No, the summer of love, if you're Vietnam, the whole kit and caboodle. If you were born in 64, you're 4 years old.
And really enjoying it.
You're not.
Dad's trying to switch you over from Star Trek to watch the news, and you're like, no!
If you're born in 64, the definitive moment for you, right, is going to be like the late 70s disco punk schism. You're going to be, 16 years old in 1980?
Well, guess what? I will be the baby boomer who comes on Friendly Fire and, you know... talks about Hellcats of the Navy or whatever. That'll be my thing.
You're going to be the boomer?
Yeah.
You're less of a boomer than me.
But I'll do a hilarious kind of John Mulaney old person character.
I think that a lot of what defines the baby boomer generation is the first, what I think of as the first half of the Cold War, right? We've talked a lot about how Generation X, and maybe not on the show, but we've talked offline about how Generation X is kind of defined by... Cold War anxiety.
Yes. I think we talk about this on about every omnibus. So we've covered this.
But
we've talked about the day after more than the people who made the day after.
That's true. That's true. More than the newspapers talked about it at the time.
Well, we've probably thought about it more than they did. They moved on to something else and we were still bedwetting.
Still. That's right. Still eyeing the cans of Spam in our parents' larder going like, please don't ever make me eat that Spam.
That's exactly right.
But our Cold War was a late 70s, 80s Cold War.
There was not a Vietnam era.
But there was a 50s, 60s Cold War that was just as paranoid and also maybe even more, the expectation was that there was an inevitability to it.
That's the hipster Cold War. They were into the Cold War before it was cool.
That's right. They had all the great film strips and little animated shorts of people trying to duck and cover.
We didn't have cute turtles.
Well, we did. We just had to watch theirs, right? And that's the terrible thing about Generation X. And why I guess maybe why we're so mistaken for boomers is that we had their terrible culture that it was in reruns.
The most upsetting scene in The Day After, to my mind, is where Tucker the Turtle, you see him ducking and covering, and then he just dies instead. there's a little animated interlude where the turtle is just killed immediately.
Well, you know, I love the Cold War. It was the
who doesn't?
It was the time that, you know, it was a very formative time for me. I had every one of those aircraft identification books where they would give little silhouettes of different airplane profiles so that you know, and the idea being that you would be a spotter for the Air Force or civilian spotter that was like, I saw two F-89 Grumman Hellcats.
Well, you were in Alaska. You'd see them coming over the dew line or whatever, right?
Right.
You could be our first eyes on the scene.
Right.
Did you ever save the nation?
I didn't. The F-89 wasn't a Hellcat, by the way. But no, I was in the Civil Air Patrol, however. Mm. As a preteen even, and as a teen, certainly was a cadet in the Civil Air Patrol with the idea that The Civil Air Patrol, and I intend very much to do an episode of Omnibus on the Civil Air Patrol exclusively, but it was a civilian auxiliary of the Air Force, still is, and it does a lot of stuff that the Air Force kind of doesn't have time to do.
Like shadowy stuff? Like
Are
you killing people?
A lot of search and rescue stuff, right? I mean, every time a little airplane goes down, somebody calls the Air Force, and they're like, look, man, we're busy.
They've got a number.
We've got other
some
stuff.
Old guy in a hangar.
Yeah, so they call the Civil Air Patrol, and the Civil Air Patrol does that.
They wake up an old guy in a hangar.
But during the... That's right, a guy with a greasy, like an oil-stained baseball cap, right, with the brim turned
up. He's like Indiana Jones's mechanic.
Wipes his hand off on a wrench and fires up the biplane.
I think it's funny that you and I kind of feel like we're the same age, but you were a member of the Civilian Air Patrol, and I was a member of, you know, the Star Wars fan club.
Right.
There's a vast gulf.
And I think I did. I mean, we believed that during an armed conflict with the Soviet Union, I would be pressed into service, perhaps in the capacity of just, you know, being in charge of my junior high. But
you didn't want to be riding the bomb.
Oh, down no, onto not riding Siberia. The bomb. No. I hoped to be one of the few that were saved.
You just wanted to be a marshal of some kind.
That's right.
I'm hoping to be, and that's a good goal. Like, yeah. If there's anything going on, you want to be a marshal. It doesn't matter whether it's a parade or martial law. If you have the choice between being a marshal and a non-marshal,
right,
one should always be a marshal.
In the case of martial law, I would definitely like to be a marshal. Absolutely. I've always said that
you'll get all the spam.
After I ran for the Seattle City Council and lost, I realized that my political career probably. I'd imagined a lifetime in politics and throughout my young life, and then realizing that I didn't really want to be in politics, but still wanted to perform my civic duty and be, in some cases, in some way, in a martial capacity. I realized what I needed to do was run for marshal of some small Western town.
You want a tin star.
I do. So I was like, maybe if I were the sheriff of Twisp, or some other. I've been toying with this idea for several years now. I think I'd be a good small town marshal.
Yeah, you need to be kind of the surprisingly gentle marshal that just takes up everybody's guns when they ride into town.
Yeah,
you're like Wyatt Earp. You're like, you need to
Well, then that,
come by the office.
That Stranger Things TV show came out, and I got a lot of letters saying, well, they're doing a show with you as the marshal.
That guy does have a very strong John Roderick energy, right?
He does. In fact, I think there was a thread online, one of these fanfic impulses that people have that pitted me against the Stranger Things marshal with like the question.
Bare knuckles boxing?
Yeah, like who would win? Who would win in a fight? And the consensus was that he would win.
Yeah, he would win.
And even though I don't contest that, I was offended.
This reminds me of something that happened to us yesterday, which is I sent you a screenshot from a Jeopardy chat group in which they were discussing who could rattle off just a record-breaking Jeopardy streak. And somebody said, you know, maybe John Roderick from Omnibus, friend of Ken's, maybe he wouldn't be like a James Holzhauer record breaker, but he would still be a TOC player. And you immediately text back, what's TOC? And I said, well, that's the Tournament of Champions. And you said, well, I'm very mad that they think I would just be a Tournament of Champions player and not a record breaker. You were so angry that your name had been mooted for something you may even not be eligible for. And somebody just said, he might be top 10, but... And that's the same with the Stranger Things.
Yeah.
You want to beat up all those characters.
I agree that I could not probably become one of the great Jeopardy champions of all time, but I'm mad that the people on the internet think so.
How dare they say so? That seems impolite. You and the Stranger Things marshal should just join forces.
I think
why are you enemies? You guys should be beating up Matthew Modine.
It's true. It's true. We should be working together. He's thicker than I am, I think. I think he's broader across the beam. And that's
what people are betting on.
Yeah, that's why people see him. But I'm not sure. And I think he may be tall also.
I bet he's tall.
We're both gentle giants. Let's just put it that way.
You two would never have a reason to fight. You would join forces. There would be no jurisdictional disputes between Twisp and Stranger Things is, of course, set in Stranger Thing, Indiana. And so you guys would respect each other's jurisdictions and fight crime.
I feel like I would wear my uniform better. Let's just put it that way.
That's probably true.
This episode of Omnibus, however, is not about...
has little to do with any of that. You have to go back all the way back and tie in war movies.
Well, what's a bummer to me is that I gave away some of my best Civil Air Patrol material, and now I'm going to have to wait for a year, and then there are going to be a bunch of people that say, he already said that. in being kind of a war fanboy...
We all love a good war.
Cold War fanboy. I became pretty well versed at a young age in like all the different kinds of airplanes. And because my dad was a World War II pilot, my father was the Greatest Generation, and those were the parents of baby boomers. So even though he had me late in life and I am very decidedly not a boomer, I do have boomer adjacency.
If he were here today, he might think of you as very boomer-like.
Well, because I have older brothers and sisters who are baby boomers, but they're 20 years older than me.
You're like the baby boomer.
I'm the baby.
Yes, you showed up at the doorstep like Sweepy.
I could have been a baby of a baby boomer. but I did associate World War II with my dad. So, well, he was in it, right?
With reason.
I felt like I was only one kiss away from that conflict and from the fan culture around all the armament and uniforms and culture of World War II.
And if you're going to be a fan of a war, World War II is a pretty good one.
It's really the best one. But I noticed among my dad and his cronies who used to sit around the living room and talk about their experiences in the war, after the war, they didn't continue to be interested in the military necessarily. You know, they reintegrated into civilian life, and they didn't make, in the same way that they didn't make the transition between big band jazz and modern jazz, they didn't make the transition between being interested in the military as it existed during World War II and as it brought, as it saved the world, made the world safe for democracy, which is how they thought of it.
Well, yeah, think of it. You just do something very intensely for 2 or 3 years in your early 20s.
Right.
You're not, that's not going to be your hobby for the rest of your life.
Well, no, but it also sets in stone kind of how you think about what the military is and how it works. And that was why Vietnam was so confounding for a lot of those guys, because they weren't used to being critical of the military. They didn't think of it that way. But there was a tremendous switch in what the military was, how it worked, what the technology was, as we moved in that immediate post-war era to what became the jet age. We transitioned right at the end of the war into a completely new universe as a result of technologies that were developed during the war. 5 years after World War II was over, there were no more, I mean, we were using all jet airplanes. There was the threat of intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Sure, there's nukes.
We were working on their nuclear warheads. We were working on satellites. You know, things were being launched into space. I mean, it was a universe apart, and the threats were like incomprehensible relative to a 1945 conception of
these people just cannot handle existential. I mean, how do we think about it today?
Well, and at the time, the technologies developing so fast, a lot of them were took war fighting out of the realm of a thing that you could do with human reaction times in a way, right? If you're in a propeller airplane and you're chasing another propeller airplane with a gun.
It's a big if, but okay. I'll try to picture it.
Still could happen. We could go down to Boeing Field right now and say, all right, what if we...
I just want to make sure I have one of the guns that doesn't shoot out the propeller. Like it knows to miss the propeller as it passes.
They figured that out pretty early.
Thank goodness.
One way to do it is put the machine guns out on the wings.
I guess that's true.
Right. But another way, they had this intermittent thing. Yeah. So your idea of dogfighting in a situation like that, I mean, a propeller aircraft can go several hundred miles an hour, but still, if the plane in front of you turns and you turn, your eyes, your reflexes can handle things in real time. I mean, things are happening fast, but you're trying to shoot another airplane down with bullets. And so a bullet has limitations. It fires and it's not guided in any way, right? It just kind of goes straight, and if the wind is blowing, it can blow the bullet. But that's all taken as a given when you're in a dogfight.
And over the next 50 years or more, that gradually gets replaced by magic, which is what we have today, right?
Right.
A screen and a button and a target.
Yeah, right. And an airplane over the horizon that you can't see, right. And missiles and things that have their own minds and their own imaginations, that play games with one another, that have false memories of knowing how to play the piano.
That have Professor Falcon.
Yeah. As that transition was made to jet aircraft that were firing missiles that would move faster than human reaction times, things were happening. I mean, jet fighters very quickly realized that to get in close enough to use a gun against one another, I mean, you would be at that point very uncomfortably close to another thing moving 700 miles an hour.
That's a real Top Gun MiG scenario.
Yeah. And actually, for a while, the Air Force took guns off of airplanes and went to a strictly missile-based style of air-to-air combat.
The pilot would have to pull out a handgun. Open his cockpit.
and that worked against us for a while, because there were lots of instances where, you know, you'd fire all your missiles and then fire all your guns and the British kept coming.
What are you then? What are you?
Right, exactly. You're just no missiles. Get out of there is what you are. But what was hard for people, I guess, to grok was that these new technologies were extremely imperfect, and
to this day, not every, you know, tragic wedding drone strike is a good idea. You know, like we are still screwing this stuff up.
We are still screwing this stuff up, and just to use your example, there are plenty of instances where someone from a drone, some drone pilot over the desert, is given the command to fire a missile, and it turns out right at the end, some child runs out and they realize, oh my goodness, it was a wedding, not a meeting of Al Qaeda.
There's nothing the pilot can do.
Nothing the pilot can do. Well, I mean, you can detonate those missiles before, at a certain point, you can push a button or whatever, they self-detonate. But that's a failure of intelligence. It's a failure of surveillance. It's not, those drone missile strikes aren't a failure of the missile.
Right.
But there are lots and lots of just straight up failures of the weapons, and in the way that they're depicted in movies and the way we think of missiles. I mean, when Tom Cruise fires a missile, it does show situations where the missile kind of, misses, right?
Typically, that's when our hero is deploying some kind of countermeasures or some super daredevil seat of his pants flying.
Right.
Our hero can make the missiles miss. The bad guys, the commies, can never do that.
Yeah, and every once in a while, one of the good guys, Iceman or whatever, fires a missile that misses. But it's only for dramatic purposes to let Tom Cruise come in and save the day with his, uncanny, eerily powerful and
Scientology powered
missiles. Right.
If only Iceman had been operating Thetan Level 6.
Remember, if you say the word Scientology on the internet, there are algorithms that will find that and target you personally.
But they're not listening to podcasts.
Oh, are they not?
Are they?
Well,
oh, now I'm in trouble. Maybe Mark can go out and take out the place where I said Scientology and put in the words. Lemonade stand.
Yeah. Bubblator.
Just say Unitarians. Tom Cruise, as we all know, is a insane Unitarian.
In the early days of developing this technology, like the first rockets that were fired from airplanes were unguided. They were basically rocket-powered bullets.
Line-of-sight thing, you point and shoot.
And they were pretty effective if you were going to aim your plane at the ground. If there were tanks and people running around and you had your fighter bomber and you could point the nose at where you wanted the rockets to go and then fire a bunch of them all at once. This was the technology.
Target-rich environment.
Yeah, just like, I just shot 100 missiles and let's get out of here. And it was pretty effective because people on the ground can't move away that fast.
And there's a big radius of what you blow up, right? If you shoot a rocket at a planet.
Yeah, you're meant to, they were meant to just kind of carpet a certain area. And a little salvo of unguided rockets can sort of devastate a football field sized area, which is, typically you get 50 people standing around. I mean, that's they wouldn't occupy an area greater than a football field. They wouldn't be a group of people at that point. They'd be 50 random people standing in.
And to you, the bright line is a football field?
Yeah, football field.
If an army can no longer fit a football field, come on.
But as an air-to-air weapon, an unguided rocket is extremely ineffective because the other person, as you described earlier, the bad guy, let's say the commie, they can turn their aircraft.
They're probably moving too.
Yes.
If they're not moving, how are they even up there?
That's right.
They're not hovering.
They're also moving.
They're not going to move in conjunction with you. You're the enemy. And why should they do what you're doing?
If you fire a rocket powered bullet, they will almost certainly try to turn away.
I sure would. But I'm not a crafty commie.
The idea of of these salvos of rockets. The idea was that they weren't very good as like a fighter plane weapon. They were meant to intercept bombers, slow moving bombers. So a bomber during this period, a strategic bomber, intercontinental ballistic missiles were still, and we're talking about the mid-50s, they were still not untested, entirely untested, but it wasn't really clear that you could fire an ICBM from Kansas and be sure that it reached its target in
Vladivostok.
In Slobovistan.
So it's more or less like using the U.S. Post Office.
It might get better. Ouch. Ouch. That's a gut punch.
So the idea was, if everybody pictured that if nuclear warheads were going to be flying, they were going to be flying from squadrons of bombers that were just always aloft.
It was definitely part of the sort of strategic puzzle that you would have multiple platforms to deliver nuclear weapons.
You've really got to diversify your portfolio.
You do. And submarines were a big part of that. They could get in close and be undetected. Bombers were detectable by radar, but you could have them airborne all the time and kind of flying around the polar space, like ready to penetrate. I mean, this is the whole plot of the movie War Games. Dr. Strangelove. They're waiting there, kind of poised right outside of the airspace of your enemy. And the Russians, or the Soviets, used strategic bombers as a major component of kind of the way that they threatened the United States. And so our early interceptors were populated with these sort of rocket launching pads. And the idea was that a bomber couldn't really evade them quite like a jet fighter could, and they could hit a bomber with a big cluster of little unguided rockets and generally be assured that they could, you know, that the rockets would perform their job.
It's SDI. It's Star Wars.
That's right.
You can stop the nukes if you can hit the bomber.
Except, you know, it's not Star Wars as much as it's Buck Rogers, right?
Yeah, it's steampunk. Like, steampunk, yeah. SDI.
Light a Roman candle and shoot them down. So by the mid-50s, a lot of these platforms that we think of, we kind of assume that rockets and guided rockets and strategic rockets were all technologies that where they'd become fairly reliable by a certain point in time. I mean, it wasn't much longer that we developed a rocket that could put men on the moon.
Right. I was just about to say, we started putting guys at the top of them.
Yeah.
We started to put our best, most clean-cut, square-jawed guys just sitting on one of these things. That's how confident we were.
And we hardly killed any of them.
But we did. There were you've seen the videos of the failed NASA rocket tests, right? Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Saturn 1 through 4 were not quite as good as Saturn 5.
That's the best part of the
Saturn 0.7 beta.
All these guys with crew cuts and sunglasses watching these rockets explode.
Because a lot of them look good for a second, yeah. And then it's literally like 50 feet.
But it's extremely hard to shoot another airplane down from an airplane.
I've never done it.
I've never done it either. And
if you and I can't
know,
get
right?
This done.
We're two pretty remarkably smart, well-versed guys.
We are can-do Americans.
We are, and we have a thumbnail sketch of physics and aerodynamics.
I would lick my finger and stick it out a couple times just to make sure the shot was good.
I've used the little testes rocket motors to not only send model rockets into the air, but also.
Did you say testes?
Yeah, well, how would you pronounce it? I always wondered about that.
You put rocket motors on your testes?
No, the rocket motor manufacturer.
Oh, it's like a hobby shop thing?
Yeah.
I never had that blow stuff up phase as a kid.
What? Really? Like,
we never even played with fireworks once Washington banned the unsafe and
insane
ones.
No, it's not testes, it's Estes.
that's gonna be a very. I just saved you from a very awkward mix-up.
Ouch!
I mean, it's a little embarrassing that future generations know that you don't know.
Oh no! You know what it is? It's that the testors. Is it testors? Was the glue? Yes. So testors was the paint and glue that you use to build model airplanes, and Estes was the rocket. So I conflated
that. And if you ever combine the two. If you put your testors on your Estes,
yeah,
you're
right.
Just left holding your testes.
That's right. Hey, wait a minute. You get your chocolate in my peanut butter. Did you never blow things up?
I hardly ever blew things up. Wow. I had friends that blew things up, and I kind of looked down on them. It's probably a classist thing again.
Yeah. I was a pyro.
I feel bad.
At a certain point in high school, we realized that, and this is terrible, I'm saying this for informational purposes only. This is not a suggestion.
Has the statute of limitations expired?
The statute? Yes, it has. No. I'm not admitting any crimes, but we started to try and we were fascinated by pipe bombs. We wanted to perfect pipe bombs.
I like how you can say I'm a mad bomber, but if you say you're fascinated with it, you're a man of science.
We were fascinated by it.
Share your scientific fascination with the pipe bomb.
And we realized that you could use the little solar igniters that we used in model rocketry. We could use those as basically the blasting caps that would set off black powder based pipe bombs. So my fascination in model rocketry continued all the way into high school, although we were using it for very different applications. Anyway, forget everything I just said. That's some anarchist cookbook stuff.
The state of Alaska has no interest in that, I'm sure.
Anyway, I certainly, as a Air Force fanboy, have always imagined that all this technology, air-to-air weapons, were more reliable than they actually were. And like sort of famously, the most there are two air-to-air missile types air-to-air missiles that were used universally in American jet fighter combat, and we sold these missiles to our arms partners around the world. There was the Sidewinder missile, which was a short-range air-to-air combat missile that was a heat seeker. So the Sidewinder would get the heat signature of the rocket the jet engine exhaust of your enemy aircraft, and it would zoom in on the exhaust, let's say.
No aiming necessary.
It just had a little...
It'll change in flight to follow the...
Yeah, it'll just follow the hottest point, but only really good for very short ranges. You could fire a Sidewinder and it would just sidewind right off into...
Hence the name.
ineffectuality if you didn't get that airplane pretty fast. And then the companion to the Sidewinder was the AIM-7 Sparrow, which was...
Sparrow's a terrible name for a missile.
Well, and the AIM-7 Sparrow was arguably a terrible missile.
Well, is that why they chose it? Like, this missile is...
I don't think so.
This missile can do no harm to anyone. What's a nice, harmless animal?
Right, like a Sidewinder, that's a nickname for a rattlesnake.
Sure, that's a snake that can bite you.
But a Sparrow... Yeah.
Sparrows, you're delighted, but they're ineffectual. You don't even notice them.
And a Sparrow missile could go further. It was a medium range missile, but it was radar targeted, and it required that the pilot of the airplane continue to point his airplane at the enemy airplane, keeping his radar locked, and then
his radar was communicating with the Sparrow.
With the Sparrow, and the Sparrow would follow the radar lock to its target. But that's not something that a pilot can continue to do in the midst of a real hot, air-to-air combat situation. And I think the statistics on how accurate Sparrows were, I mean, what their actual sort of kill ratio was.
It's equivalent to real Sparrows.
Like, pretty bad, right? It would, I mean, better than like rubber bands, but like not quite as good as, just accident. I think more enemy pilots just crashed because they didn't get their landing gear down in time than were killed by Sparrows. I'm sure there's somebody listening to the show that worked on the AIM-7 Sparrow that's going to send us a really angry email.
Yeah, well, it might not be an angry email. If you're going to anger someone, it should not be a former weapons contractor.
Right, somebody that has...
He's still got a garage full of... shady stuff.
He's going to send us a letter written in chalk on the side of an AIM-7 Sparrow. just send your letters to Ken Jennings at...
Ken Jennings Hates America at...
HowStuffWorks.com.
So the Sidewinder works. The Sparrow doesn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, all missiles are unreliable to a certain extent. I mean, the Sidewinder works for what it does.
Do you have a particular example of the unreliability of any of these missiles, John?
Just the statistics of how many were fired in combat versus how many actually brought down planes. Pretty you know, if that was your success rate in parenting, you would, your kids would have been taken away.
Also, you know, you never think about the price of the missile, you know.
They're expensive too.
Like when my kid throws away her retainer, the first thing I think is, oh my gosh, how much was that retainer?
Well, I think you do as a fighter pilot think of the cost of using a missile because you're not carrying that many of them. And so if you use one, it's an opportunity cost.
I'm a taxpayer. I don't care about that guy. I just want to hear, wait, $60 million for that missile that you just accidentally fired?
Well, in fact, during this period, there was another kind of missile used in air-to-air combat, which was called the Air-2 Genie. And the Genie, here, you're going to love this.
Seems like it's like a kitchen cleaning technology. Genie doesn't seem like a name for a weapon.
Well, the Genie was a nuclear-tipped air-to-air missile, the idea being that it was so hard to hit other airplanes that if you just put a nuke on the tip and fired it at a group of airplanes,
you'll probably get them.
You'll get them. And the only challenge was, like, can you fire this missile and get away from it fast enough that it doesn't also shoot yourself down?
Well, hopefully there were rules of engagement that would have, I mean, you don't want pilots just shooting nuclear tipped missiles at planes.
Oh, do you not? Well you're not in the Air Force.
There are a few things that could go wrong in that scenario. I'm just a layperson, but
yeah. And the safety measures in a lot of these missiles are that they don't arm until a certain point. And if they don't detonate within a certain time frame, then they disarm. But all of those things are not 100% reliable technologies. The Genie was in use in the Air Force for a lot longer than you would think, given...
Well, the fact that I never heard about this means it probably didn't get fired much.
At one point, well, no, it was only ever fired, I think, one time.
We never actually irradiated Turkey or Siberia.
But during the testing of the Genie, there was a group of Air Force officers who volunteered to go stand out on the firing range and take their hats off and have this Genie fired over their heads at 20,000 feet and detonate to demonstrate that the nuclear explosion would not hurt people on the ground.
Even if they weren't wearing a fedora.
Even when they take their little Air Force, you know, like volley hat off. They weren't even wearing, even the Jewish officers took off their yarmulkes.
Oh, there were no Jewish officers.
Probably not in the Air Force. They're all born again Christians. And they did this. These officers stood out there and a nuke went off over their heads and they measured the rads and there was no measurable damage. That's not a test I would have. I don't have that much confidence.
Is that true in general of like atmospheric nuclear detonations? Fallout doesn't get to the ground?
I
wouldn't bank on that.
I think depending on the size, and these air-to-air missiles had, you know, 1 kiloton loads or something. They weren't like the mega, they weren't like czar bombers or anything.
Costco-sized nukes.
Yeah. But the process of testing these missiles, of course, is complicated because you're, even though Air Force officers are willing to stand out and have nukes blown up over their heads, they're not willing to get in an airplane and fly while their friend actually tries to shoot them down with an air-to-air missile. And I think for obvious reasons, because they would die. And so drones were used by both the Air Force and the Navy as platforms to try and test the efficacy of this kind of stuff. And we've always used drones, but drones not as not like we use them now, which are piloted jets. It's just the pilot is sitting somewhere else. Drones were obsolete aircraft that were fitted with kind of remote control, almost like a model airplane.
So there was some kid with a little joystick.
There
somewhere?
Was somebody, you know, a pilot that had a radio transmitter.
They didn't
transmitter.
Just go in a straight line. It's not like Skeet.
No. Right.
Pew!
Look, wind them up. Set them free. And so during this early era of missile testing, ground-to-air missiles and air-to-air missiles, the Navy and the Air Force used old World War II surplus aircraft that, because at the end of World War II, right, we'd manufactured so many battleships and so many airplanes and tanks, and, you know, what were we supposed to do with all that stuff?
We should have rented some of it, it turns out.
I mean, one of the tragedies of that post-war era is that all that stuff was just destroyed en masse, so much so that now there are only a handful of extant examples of some of the, you know, the great airplanes and ships of all of human time, right? I mean, like,
I have to say that's not a problem I've noticed. I feel like I've had to go to many, many old aircraft museums,
air shows
in my life, and it seems like there's plenty of them.
Like
they're all painted with some kind of snarling animal face on the nose, or a swimsuit lady.
Even ones that weren't. That never had that at the time.
Yeah, I was painting that.
I think
I was asked to leave.
A lot of the, that's right. It was just a regular airplane, and you were there with
I'm just painting naked women on everything in this museum, and they don't. The volunteers don't like that.
You had your little testors paint kit.
You can outrun a lot of those guys, though. It turns out.
Well, a lot of those airplanes were
reserve uniforms.
Were ones that never left the United States, or ones that were manufactured after the war ended. You know what? Like airplanes and boats that were in the Philippines were often just sort of burned or buried where they stood. Well, the PT boat made famous by John F. Kennedy, most of those boats were beached and set on fire at the end of the war. There are hardly any that remain. But one of the things that the Air Force did was keep a selection of those airplanes to wind them up and set them loose and shoot them down. And, one of the ones that they used for this task was, and I kind of gave the, I gave this away in a earlier in the episode, was the Grumman F-6F, which was a extremely successful Navy airplane during the war. It was a carrier-based plane that that did a lot of shooting down of Japanese Zeros, and at the end of the war, we had a bunch of them, and some of them were used in this drone program to provide targets for this kind of testing. And in the mid-50s, this was the Hellcat, the F-6F.
Hellcats of the Navy.
The Hellcats of the Navy,
this is
that's
the
right.
movie I want us to do on our new war podcast, where we do unpopular war movies.
Yeah, where I talk... Where
Unfriendly Fire.
I talk about them and you go, huh? In 1956... in California, there were a lot of old military bases that were still being used for these purposes, fighting the Russians by proxy
from California.
And on that's right. And on August 16th of 1956, there was an event that has gone down in history, popularly known as the Battle of Palmdale. And it didn't go down in history is the interesting thing. It is not popularly known as the Battle of Palmdale. It was largely forgotten and only rediscovered and resurrected as a focal point of interest in the 2000s.
I had never heard of it before today. Spoilers.
So let me sketch out what happened on that fateful day. The Navy launched an F-6F as a drone out over the Pacific Ocean to use as a target for some missile tests.
Other planes are supposed to come, or are they surface to air?
My sense is on that day that it was a surface to air test, mm-hmm. And the Navy was going to fly this out into a gun range that was over the Pacific Ocean. So there was a military base called Point Magoo, which is kind of it's Magoo. It's M-A-G-U, not like, oh, it's not like the blind.
It's not like Mr. Magoo, because that's not a good name character for a marksmanship exercise. Operation Magoo, sir, is on the clock.
And Point Magoo is kind of in Ventura County, north of Los Angeles and south of Santa Barbara. Uh-huh. It was the airport. Point Magoo was the airport that was closest to Ronald Reagan's Santa Barbara ranch. So it was the one, if anyone's heard of it.
Air Force One still.
Yeah, Air Force One would take him there if he was going to his ranch to like cut down his neighbor's trees or whatever it was that he did up there in Santa Barbara. But Point Magoo for you know, for a lot of the second half of the 20th century, was used as a Navy gun range. And they had land, upland, that they could use to test missiles where the missiles wouldn't presumably like hurt anybody. And it also went out to the sea. So on this day, August 16th, they launched this F-6F, remotely piloted. They had a little guy on the ground with a radio, and inside the airplane was a radio. And you can only imagine the complex little system of...
I'm imagining a robot. There's a robot sitting in the cockpit, and the remote control actually works the robot, so he pulls the stick.
I think it was some wires and some broomsticks, yeah, maybe.
It's the thing that Ferris Bueller uses to seem like he's snoring in bed.
Exactly what it was, gotcha. Right? Pulleys and a series of tubes. But very shortly after takeoff, because of some malfunction, I mean, this isn't like a foolproof system, they lose contact with the airplane. The guy on the ground can no longer, and it's either the radio on the ground or the radio in the plane. Something stopped working.
Either way, they cannot no longer control this. It's just going to keep going in a straight line.
There it goes.
Until it runs out of fuel.
You would think it would keep going in a straight line, but in fact, the plane started to, I mean, an airplane wants to fly. It's the amazing thing about an airplane. Once it's in the air, a lot of times they advise you if an airplane kind of goes out of control, one of the first things you try is just take your hands and feet off of the controls, and the airplane will naturally stabilize, unless it's in some situation like a flat spin or, I mean, an airplane can go out of control where it won't recover, but in a lot of cases, if you're in a dive or whatever, I mean, you can just take your hands off and the plane will naturally assume a kind of stable level flight.
Does this only work for cute planes where the cockpit windows have eyeballs on them and the nose is a propeller?
Yeah, that's right. They just want to fly.
Petey the plane just wants to be up there.
Other normal airplanes want to crash, but Petey the airplane wants to fly. There was a famous episode in the late 60s called the Cornfield Bomber where an F-106 jet went out of control, so out of control that the pilot ejected and in the process, the force of the ejection seat and the change in the weight and dynamics of the airplane.
Sure, equal and opposite reaction. And all
the
that.
Flight, the plane itself recovered from the flat spin and began to just fly on its own. The pilot then, you know, sitting underneath his parachute, like some of his fellow pilots, like radioed him, like, you better get back in it because it's flying now.
It's the equivalent of getting out of the car to check your mail and watching it start to roll down the driveway. You're like, no.
You can imagine this guy's embarrassment, like, oh, you couldn't control the airplane. Well, good thing you got out of it. And this plane continued to fly and basically like landed belly up landing in a cornfield.
Planes don't just want to fly. They also want to eat corn.
Well, this plane like landed in the dirt with its motor still running and just sat there with the jet engine on, kind of slowly inching its way across a cornfield. And the plane was mostly undamaged. They fixed it and it flew.
Wow.
Continued to fly. One of the only examples I think of that. But so this F-6F, which was painted bright red and yellow and was meant, you know, to be visible as a target, continued to fly, but it went into a kind of slow banking turn.
Oh.
And started to head back to land. Which
you hate to see it.
Became an enormous problem, right? It was
unbeknownst to all the people for whom it was actually a problem.
It
was starting to become a problem.
This is now flying over LA.
For three guys in a tower somewhere.
And so some jets were scrambled from an Air Force base, nearby Air Force base, who were Air Force pilots, and they were sent to shoot this airplane down. And there's a lot of competition between Air Force pilots and Navy pilots, and I'm sure that there was quite a bit of like a good-natured ribbing, like, oh, the Navy can't control their old airplane. Let's send the Air Force up to get it.
We're speaking to a future audience from that rivalry is probably long dead. So you can finally say, and with no fear of reprisals, who actually has the superior pilots?
Which I prefer.
Yeah, in your opinion.
Well, if you look at the number of astronauts that were Navy pilots versus astronauts that were Air Force pilots, there was a preponderance of Navy pilots within the early astronaut corps. But the Air Force was a new branch of the service. There was no Air Force prior to the end of World War II. It was the Army Air Corps up until that point. And so Air Force was new, and also Air Force was strategic bomber focused. The
skill fighters were mostly Navy?
Were Navy and Marine pilots. Air Force pilots then quickly became the great fighter duelists of later years. But the Navy, continues to be, Top Gun is about Navy pilots.
I've seen the Blue Angels. They're very good at making a little lozenge shape.
Right.
Which then maybe turns into some kind of a star shape.
Those are also Navy pilots. The Thunderbirds. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, the Thunderbirds are the Air Force. Good. And you would assume that the Air Force would really pour money into the Thunderbirds, but they don't.
Do you know why? Because everyone just assumes the Blue Angels are Air Force. They're like, oh, I love the Air Force. I saw the Blue Angels. Some Air Force general's like, arr.
Well, so the Air Force sent up some F-89s, which were a jet-powered interceptor. But they didn't have any guided air-to-air missiles. All they had were these rocket pods under their aircraft, which were, as we've discussed, unguided rockets. And they had 100, each plane had 104 rockets in these big circular pods that they could fire. But the way they worked was they fired in clusters. And so the Air Force got up and started first they had to find this relatively slow moving autopiloted, plane just sort of flying on its own wherewithal.
Do-do-do.
And then they had to shoot it down. Well, the challenge was, as you're coming up behind an airplane, it presents a pretty small target. And also, this plane was in a constant turn. So to shoot it down from behind, as soon as you shot your unguided bullets, rocket bullets, the plane in front of you would just
turn away.
So they adopted the tactic that they were going to come sideways at it and shoot their rockets sort of
broadside.
Yeah, try and lean it in the Navy. And broadside it and shoot it down. And so the pilots, one of whom was named Einstein, Lieutenant Einstein, one of whom was Lieutenant Herleman.
Can you imagine all his subordinates just being like, hey, nice shot, Einstein?
Yeah, exactly.
And he'd be like, hey.
The rest of his life, he had to live this down. They fired their rockets in what was called the ripple effect, clusters of 42 rockets, and then 32 rockets in the second cluster, and then 70 rockets at the end. Like,
I have not been keeping track, but that's well over 100 rockets.
That's 104 rockets, right? Or no, that's quite a bit more rockets. Well, let's see. How did they do that? 42, 32, and... Oh, no, I'm sorry. Not 70. 42, 30, and 30.
Gotcha. So it's just over 100 rockets.
Just over 100 rockets. So Lieutenant Einstein fires his whole complement of rockets at this drone and misses. At one point, I think some of the rockets bounced off
it's more of an equipment failure than a pilot.
I think it was they didn't hit it directly and bounce off. They like skimmed off the wing or like just sort of grazed the bottom and were sent cattywampus.
Like in Star Wars, I just impacted on the surface.
Red leader. And then Lieutenant Herleman came in behind him and also missed with 104 rockets. So they sent 208 unguided rockets at this relatively slow-moving Hellcat and missed entirely. But as you can imagine, these rockets did not disappear into thin air. The Hellcat was flying over the Mojave Desert, the Antelope Valley, in south central California. And these rockets flew off completely willy-nilly.
Was anybody worried about this? Had anybody, like, were the pilots aware that every time they missed the drone, they might be hitting a barn?
This is one of the questions for the ages, right? The Air Force did not expect to miss, presumably.
100, 200, whatever times?
I mean, these rockets were most effective as ground attack weapons, but I think because they were out over the largely uninhabited Antelope Valley and Mojave Desert, they assumed that these rockets would just sort of, I don't know what, the impact harmlessly in the desert. They didn't think this all the way through. And the rockets did then land various places, peppering the earth.
I need to know how funny I can find this. I need to know how many civilians died. Like, maybe we should just lead with that on every entry. Here's how you know.
In the city of Newhall, California, rockets landed in the town. Bounced off the ground. One rocket exploded, and the shrapnel went into a woman's kitchen. And some of the shrapnel actually ended up in her kitchen cupboards.
But not in the woman.
Not in the woman.
Oh, good.
No one died.
Oh, okay.
There were a couple of guys who had pulled their truck over to have lunch under a shady tree, and a rocket hit their truck and blew it up, but they were just sitting there eating sandwiches. That must have been a very confusing moment.
Can you imagine?
Like, you're just like having a sandwich.
Do you think the guy behind the wheel immediately like started the truck and just booked out of there? Because who knows where the next explosion
is
going to be?
No, the truck is gone. The truck blew up.
The truck's gone.
Yeah, the truck was hit. I mean, it's one of those like, he hates these cans. You know, what could you say?
Not again.
One of the brush fires actually got... the fire burned to within 300 feet of something called the Burmite Powder Explosives Company.
Not the BPEC.
Yeah, the BPEC, who were in the process of making bombs out in the desert, and this rocket
landed.
What's
the safest place?
I mean, what are the chances? I almost wish the Burmite Powder Factory had blown up, just because what a much better story it would be.
I would be mad that there was no video. I'm sure there's no video.
In the end... there's no video at the time. You'd have to get your Super 8 home camera out and get a cartridge in there and wind it up.
Would the Air Force planes have had
no
cameras
not.
In planes then?
Probably. Well, there would have been cameras in combat aircraft, but they probably hadn't been loaded with film.
They didn't have time. Scramble the pilots and the cameramen.
In the end, like over 1,000 acres of brush fire were started by these rockets.
Oh, no.
That burned various places, did a considerable amount of damage in the desert. And the Air Force pilots really had nothing to report except to land and shrug as fires raged out of control. And in the end, our heroic Grumman F-6F...
The runaway drone?
Just flew on and ended up clipping some phone wires and cartwheeling in the desert, just crashed ineffectually on its own.
Nearby in the Mojave?
Yeah. Started no fires, presumably. And they went out and repaired the phone wires. And this was all sort of brought to light by a couple of guys whose hobby was to go out and find the wreckage of old airplanes that had crashed in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And they heard about this story and went out and...
This is decades later?
This is in the 2000s.
Oh, so like at the time there were not even headlines about...
There were stories about it, but it faded into obscurity,
yeah.
You know, almost immediately. And they found the crash site where there was still wreckage all strewn along the ground. And they could look up and see in the phone wires the electrical wires that they were still... The splices were still visible... Where the plane had cut through the wires and then it had been repaired by the lineman.
It seems like what we learn here is that when things are spiraling out of control, you should really just sit tight.
Sure.
You should not try to help.
Leave it alone.
Just don't do anything. Like the plane's probably just going to, you're just going to make things worse.
Yeah. The plane wants to fly.
And that concludes the Battle of Palmdale. Entry 104.EZ2047. Certificate number 31303 in the omnibus. Futurelings, we hope that the plague of social media, so prevalent in our time, has missed your century completely. You probably don't even have whatever appendages you would need to type status updates into Twittergram or whatever you have. But John and I were so devoted to the lofty principles of the Omnibus Project, that we made sure that updates were frequently posted at Omnibus Project on every social media network we could think of. We were individually at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick on Twitter, and in John's case on Instagram as well. We were available to receive electronic communication from interested fellow scholars at our email address, as it was called, which was theomnibusproject@gmail.com. We would receive physical artifacts.
We would.
From time to time.
Do it. Send us some stuff.
P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. I have a Canadian mini comic that's been sitting in my car for weeks that I don't know if I ever showed you, but it was from the mailbox.
It was a Canadian mini comic? You know, we often have people will send us one thing, and you and I will sit and study it, and it's usually fairly obvious which of us wants it. And you tend to take a lot of the printed media and leave it at my house. Right, you read it, you look at it, and then you're like,
it's true that I have the ultimate Battle of Palmdale option. If I do nothing, this thing will sit at your house, and that's great.
And you can be relatively assured that it will get archived at my house, right? If you ever, like a year from now, if you're like, I'd like to, what about that lady that sent us those autobiographical self-published books? I'll have them.
It gets archived in a very loose sense.
Well, I mean,
your team of archivists does not have to go into the stacks.
I have a shelf of books that were written by my friends. I have a shelf, and that, you know, that is a fairly substantial bookshelf.
You have plenty of smart friends,
and you have written.
It's just shocking that it hasn't rubbed off on you.
Just you alone has written an entire shelf of those books. And then I have a shelf of books that have been sent to me that have been endorsed or autographed, like to John from friend. I have, now a shelf of books that people who listen to the Omnibus have sent us.
Just books of 18th century train locomotive crashes.
That's right.
Or whatever.
From, books that were sent to us from Israel. And I think increasingly, like, that archive it's taking up a corner of my library.
What a valuable resource that will be someday. What a confusing resource that will be.
We'll put it in a time capsule along with these recordings.
You probably found it when you dug out this golden cylinder, music box looking cylinder. You were like, why is there a book about Canadian locomotive crashes?
Yeah.
You could support the aims of the Omnibus Project financially as well. A little scratch, as we said. Do you like when people call money a little scratch?
Yeah, some clams.
A few smackaroos would be invaluable for helping the project. And many generous donors. And John and I have been very touched by the outpouring of support.
We have.
Because we're speaking into the void here. We don't know what the show means to people. We don't even know if they're people. But apparently, if the Patreon donation mechanism exists in your chronal era, please navigate it to it now and contribute at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Many people who did and were enthusiastic supporters of the show can be found at the Futurelings group on Facebook and probably like-minded subreddits.
There are a couple of subreddits. I leave it to you to...
Are they like-minded?
Yes.
Because when I meet somebody great, I'm like, you know what I want? Like-minded people.
Like-minded people. These, I think the Omnibus, there is no current place on the internet I know where people who hate the Omnibus congregate.
And would we promote it if there was?
I think my tendency is to say, like, you know, both sides.
We need to teach the controversy. Don't forget to go to facebook.com/groups/futurelingssuck. I guess whatever URL I say, somebody is going to start it. Anti-futurelings.
There are definitely futurelings who go on the site to add addenda and often criticize one or the other of us. My favorite was the post the other day that said that they preferred one of your episodes to one of mine. And I was, again, rightfully... like chuffed.
Did you,
offended, not chuffed. Chuffed. That's the opposite.
Chuffed is the opposite.
Chuffed is pleased.
Yeah, you replied, no, it wasn't.
I said disagreed.
Disagree. I, of course, agreed.
I think that they were mad because the episode I did had generated a lot of fan response, whereas the episode that you did had was greeted with crickets.
It was Quonset huts. Yeah. People can post photos of a Quonset hut.
Right. And they really liked it. They liked the Quonset hut episode because they like to participate with photos of ones they've found.
The high-minded. So really, the secret to Future League success is just to make an episode called Manhole Covers. And people will be like, oh boy, I see a manhole cover. I'm going to show the boys.
Your episode was on some esoteric math. Which one was the one that they can that they compared?
On, yeah, it was on the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole. No, it was about droodles.
Oh, droodles. They liked it.
A barely corporeal thing that has not existed in physical form for 70 years. Right. Much harder to photograph. I'm going to just do vampires and yetis and Marlowe from now on. Things you can't take photographs of.
Do not take photographs of Marlowe. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived or whether or not the books and pamphlets we put into the omnibus capsule are still readable.
Maybe they've decomposed.
They certainly have
some foxing.
They have foxing.
I knew you were going to say
it. You got ahead of me. You were like, I saw the F forming in your lips.
What about what's it called when they make the little wormholes? Like, did you know that like bookworms will literally go through pages and you can actually figure out which books pages are from? They often do this in case of manuscript theft by following the tracks that the little worm has made, like vertically through the pages of the book.
Really? So if somebody has taken pages out or they've become unbound,
people that have swiped maps or other illuminations from university libraries, you can actually prove which place it came from because of the wormholes.
Well, we hope and pray that this catastrophe, where worms eat all of our manuscripts, never comes. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.